just going to say a brief bit about Saria Gupta, for those of you that won't know her. She came around the London Buddhist Centre, and she was a very young woman, and got ordained in 97, when we were 28. She's still very young. She's got a 16-year-old son, and when I first knew, I think you're working as a social worker, aren't you? But you got involved with the classical music sort of scene and set up an organisation. She set up an organisation which she now runs. So, no longer run home. So you're a free woman then?
Yeah, almost, yeah.
We'll have you back then. So I'm really pleased that Saria Gupta agreed. We were just talking on an order event, and whenever I talk to people, order events, I think, would you like to come to Croydon and give a talk? Mm. She said yes. Yeah. I'm so pleased. She said yes, and here she is.
Saria Gupta.
Thank you. Thank you, actually. It's great to be here. It's my first time, actually, at Croydon. So I'm excited, just because I've heard so much about it over the years, and I don't think I've been to West London, had the delights of West London High Street either. West Croydon High Street, so that was a good travelling through that. I was happy when Dirk actually asked me to do this talk, and particularly because it was talking about my relationship with Bhante Sangharakshita. So I've always felt a strong connection with Bhante, that's really remained pretty constant, I would say, from my first involvement with the movement. And really, I would say, it's just grown as my understanding of the Dharma has grown and my appreciation of what he's imparted to us and the significance of that has grown as well. So I'll be mostly, in this talk, focusing on my relationship with Bhante as a Dharma teacher, as my Dharma teacher, and the impact some of his teachings have had on me. And also, Bhante as an example of someone who's lived a very engaged, wholehearted Dharma life, and the example that has set for me as well. So, you'll get quite a bit about me in this talk about Bhante and his teachings. So, as Dirk actually said, I was 21 when I got involved, and I was consciously looking for spiritual guidance. I sort of spent about 2 years from the age of 19 to 21 in a kind of intense period of searching. I was reading lots of books on psychology, New Age books like The Road Less Travelled, and I was reading philosophy, the arts, and really sort of delved into the arts and culture as well. And I was looking for what is life about, and specifically what's my life about. And this period of searching culminated in a series of experiences I had, which really I felt sort of catapulted me onto a path, that started a momentum. So in one of these experiences, I was on a plane. I was flying back from the Philippines. I had a very sort of challenging time. It was a holiday, but it turned into this quite... sort of strange experience being there, sort of encountering corruption, encountering poverty, huge wealth. It was a real sort of holiday of contrast, and it threw up lots of questions for me. So I was really relieved to be coming back to England, and just you know wanting to think about what I'd experienced out there. And on the flight back home, it's a long flight, sort of 18 hours journey, and that we hit some turbulence, as one does, and it was uncomfortable. But probably about midway, the turbulence became really, really bad, and it felt like the plane was dropping sort of hundreds of feet. It may not have been, but it felt like that. And we all got really tense in the plane, and the air hostesses then also got really tense and frantic, and then were sort of marching up and down, sort of shouting at us. It felt like they were shouting at us to get our seatbelts on, and you know, just very. They looked tense too, and then the captain was actually trying to reassure us all, and not doing a very good job of it, because we then really got frightened, and I was clutching, my seat, and looking around, and everybody else was also, you know, sort of frantic. And then the Philippines is a Catholic country, so many people on board started got their rosaries out and started, you know, praying. And and I realised then, I thought, well, I've got nothing to go to. I sort of had rejected Christianity before that, so I realised I had nothing to comfort me at that point. And so, yeah, I sort of was panicking and just didn't know what to do. Scared of dying, basically. I thought this could be it. This journey home could be the last journey that I take. And at that point, I looked out the window. I just saw the most beautiful sky I'd ever seen. There were just lots of colours layered on top of each other. So there was blues and purples and sort of indigos, and then moved into orange, and then a bright gold and yellow. And there was a star, I remember, sort of shining with all the dark colours, one single star. And I just looked at this scene, and I couldn't believe what I was seeing, really. It was almost quite unearthly. That's how I described it at the time. A kind of magical appearance just suddenly there. And I gazed at it, and then eventually I sort of turned my head back to the plane. And something sort of fundamental had changed. People still had their rosaries out, people still looked really frightened, we were still dropping feet, what had changed was me. I realised the fear had gone. I was now really feeling a deep calm and a really sort of pleasant feeling in my body, which was such a contrast to how I'd been feeling just a few moments before. And I was no longer panicking, my mind felt very clear, and at that point I made a decision. In fact, I feel like it was a vow that I made. And I vowed that if I landed safely, I would go in search of the questions that I had. So questions such as, you know, how do I live a meaningful life? How do I live fully? How do I love? How do I give of myself? How do I enjoy, you know, my life and help others at the same time? How do one of the things I really wanted was to die without regret. So how do I do that? So we did land safely. And a few days later, I found myself at home at my parents' house and was about to get out of bed, and I was unable to move. I don't know what happened. I just was in pain from my neck downwards. And that just, you know, because I kind of got back and it was like, okay, I'm back now. And life could have just carried on. The questions I had could have receded. But there I was now, back in a state of fear and anxiety. So, and that lasted for quite some time. But at one point, in one night, I spent the day in pain, in bed, and just upset, really. And same questions emerged for me. And I went to sleep, and I had left the radio on. And I woke up in the middle of the night, sort of in the dead of night, to a refrain, a very beautiful voice, singing "A Love Supreme, A Love Supreme, A Love Supreme." And it was John Coltrane, and he just had such a melodious, deep voice that, again, the kind of fear and anxiety and trouble of mine that I had just, you know, went, really. And it was interesting because I knew that song. I'd heard the song before, but I certainly hadn't connected with it. And I knew at that point that he wasn't talking about a romantic love. I knew that he was talking about something unconditional universal, something that was universal. And it gave me sort of hope, that song, because I kind of felt like, well, he knows something, you know, he's kind of on a journey himself. I just felt that from listening to this tune. Because he's got this very deep melodious voice, and then the saxophone just goes into his crescendo. I felt that he was a seeker. So that song opened up the world for jazz for me in a big way, and also it made me know, well, there is something I can seek. I'm a seeker now. So I had a few more months of searching and trying things out. Like, I remember, being back at my room, I was studying, and I lit a candle and I was trying to watch the flickering flame, trying to sort of steal my mind. I thought, if I steal my mind, I can just know myself a bit more. I just would know what's going on in myself a bit more. I remember trying to do that, but everything I tried didn't quite, sort of work. And I was just got to the point where I thought, I just need help. I just need someone to show me the way. So I was studying at Bristol University at that point, and I was telling a friend, I was in the law faculty, and I was like, I just can't communicate with people in the way that I used to, and I find, conversations superficial. And she was kind of looking at me like, what's wrong with you? And I was like, I don't really know what's wrong with me. I just want a different kind of communication, different kind of conversation. And at that point, somebody walked up to the stairs and put a leaflet on the table we were standing next to, and it was Bristol Buddhist Centre Creative Communication Workshop. So there we go. I sort of took it up, and my friend was very kind, and she came with me to the centre. So when I got to the centre, people were very friendly, which was great, and I picked up two books, one on death and dying, a sort of New Age one, and one on Bante's book, Vision and Transformation. It's now called The Noble Eightfold Path. And I read his chapter on vision, and I was amazed. He's totally described some of the experiences I've been having. So he says in the book, for some people, this path of vision arises as a result of personal tragedy, bereavement or loss. Their whole existence is disturbed and upset, as though by a great earthquake in which everything they had cherished or held dear is laid low. In this wreck, this ruin of their lives, they start questioning, start looking deeper, and start wondering about the meaning and purpose of existence. So he goes on to say that as varied as we are as human beings, as varied as these experiences, direct intuitive experiences will arise for us. So it could be through nature, through art, through the end of relationships, jobs. And what I got from that book is that it was really important to kind of honour those experiences, and no matter how disturbing or uncomfortable they might feel, because there are a call from our deeper nature, from truth itself. So when I read that book, and I thought, Bante's just speaking to me. It was almost like he's written it for me. And he was essentially telling me that those experiences I had were definitely not enough. They were important, but they were not enough. I now had to sort of transform my whole being in the light of those experiences, so that I could live day to day, moment by moment, in accordance with the truth I had glimpsed. So that involved my communication, my work, my actions, just showing that these things were not one-off events, but could be, an unfolding process. And that's how I was introduced to the Buddha's teaching, the Noble Eightfold Path. So I found the teaching was really straightforward, really direct. I still recall how amazed and excited I was, reading that book. And I knew I was going to do my best to follow this path. I didn't know any Buddhists. It was literally a leaflet that I picked up. Knocking on the door, people seemed okay. But the next step, I thought, well, I'm going to go on retreat. They talked about a retreat. So a couple of weeks after that, I went on retreat, and I was terrified, actually. I thought, I just don't know what I'm going to find. And this is back in the day when, it's not, now it's kind of fashionable and trendy, if you like, but then it definitely wasn't. My friend came along with me again. And I soon relaxed, because people were friendly, and the environment was a nice environment. I sat in meditation. I hadn't gone there for meditation. I'd gone there for these questions that I wanted to get answered. We were taught meditation, so I remember sitting in the shrine, I'm totally, distracted most of the time. But that was normal, I wasn't perturbed by that. And then it was a Sunday afternoon, I think probably the very last sit that we did, that I felt this sort of real calm descending on me. I felt very relaxed. It was beautifully silent. All you could hear was the birds. And I felt like I was smiling. My whole body was smiling. And I thought, oh, this is happiness. This is it, right here. And then I sort of had an image of the Buddha, and particularly the Buddha's smile came to me. And I was really fascinated because I was like, you know, it was just a very subtle smile, and yet sort of somehow within it I felt there was truth and love. So I felt like I met the Buddha then, felt like it was a very direct meeting with the Buddha. So, I had the book, Vision and Transformation. I'd done my first retreat. I encountered the Buddha. And then one of the mitras on the retreat, I think I went back to a couple of more classes, but then he said to me, there's an event in London, actually. Do you want to go to it? So I was like, okay, fine. And my family live in London, in East London, so I thought I'll sort of coincide with a trip to them. He said Bhante Sangharakshita would be there. So I thought, great, I can meet the man who's written this book. So I walked into York Hall, which is right near the London Buddhist Centre. And there were hundreds of people there. And I was used to, my little experience I had was at Bristol Centre, where there was a dozen people would be at the class. So suddenly to walk into this hall with hundreds of people was really, you know, quite something. And it was a really lively atmosphere, a real sense of occasion. Lots of people greeting each other. I could see there was lots of big characters there. And at the front of the stage was a huge photo of a Tibetan monk, a lama. And, you know, there were people on stage. Bhante was there and proceedings began. And I've got a memory of him being in a tweed jacket, Bhante. And he was just unusual. I thought, he's unlike anyone else I've ever met. He kind of reminded me, I thought, well, he's a bit like one of my professors. But he could also be like a, you know, very kind GP type character. I was trying to place him, but I couldn't place him. He spoke really in a very sort of deliberate, thoughtful way, without, you know, deliberation. And he had a real sense of humour. There was a glint in his eyes every now and again, a kind of flash that I saw. And he communicated with real depth and clarity. But he wasn't the focus of the event. The focus was this monk on the picture, this lama, they were actually celebrating the first death anniversary of Dado Rinpoche, who was a friend of Bhante's and one of his teachers. I was impressed by all the speakers. They all seemed really confident and self-assured. Men and women spoke about their meeting with this lama, Dado Rinpoche. And there's one woman in particular I remember speaking who I just found her speech very beautiful, and I remember thinking, she seems very ethical, and that must be very beautiful to be ethical like that. Then I discovered, well, Bhante spoke about Dado Rinpoche as being a living bodhisattva. So that was a new term for me. But I know that even if the term hadn't been explained, somehow I would have got a sense of what it was from the stories people were sharing, because person after person just spoke about this Dado's unfailing generosity, his kindness, his connection to people, to children. He set up a school for Tibetan refugees and they taught arts and culture there. His devotion to practice, he'd get up really early and spend hours in the morning before starting his day practicing. And his ability to teach the Dharma, he'd given Bhante really some important instructions, including the Bodhisattva ordination. And then as well, the care he had to Bhante's disciples and students who went out to see him. So hours later, I decided at the beginning of the day I was going to pop in and have a quick look and then go to see my family. But hours later, I was still there. And a whole other vision had opened up for me. So I think before that, I saw, well, you know, there's this Noble Eightfold Path I've discovered, and I can change myself somehow following that. But then I discovered this about, well, I discovered this about the role, the realm, really, of the Bodhisattva, someone who's dedicated to the welfare of all beings, and someone in whom the sort of bodhicitta, the altruistic principle, is expressing itself through. And at the end, it was announced that they were going to do a sevenfold puja. I remember there's only one person I knew in the room, and I said to him, you know, what's a puja? And he said, well, you're about to find out. and it was quite alarming on one level, because all these people prostrating full length in front of, you know, this picture of Dada. And so my consciousness and my conditioning, my Christian condition particularly, was like, oh, this is really weird. What are people, are they doing? But at the same time, I was really deeply moved. And I kind of wanted to prostrate as well. I didn't, but I really wanted to. So I kind of mentally prostrated, because I just was so touched and moved by the stories I'd heard. And then we had the Heart Sutra, and I was transfixed by that as well. I kind of didn't understand the puja really on one level, but then I knew when I heard the Heart Sutra, I thought, this is the truth. I don't really know what it means, but it is the truth. And I thought, well, if this is Buddhism, this is the essence of Buddhism, then I am a Buddhist. And because it represented something that was way beyond me. I thought, I can never get bored of this. It's way beyond me. And it's something I can keep growing towards. And then, of course, hearing about this monk, Dada Rinpoche, this Lama, incarnate Lama, and, you know, just seeing an example of what a fully lived life looks like. What a compassionate heart, how it is, and what a clear mind is like. Just getting a sense of that real unobstructed, free, unfailingly kind, intelligent, energetic. I just got all of that from hearing about his life, and I could see what a difference a being like that makes in the world. How rare it is, and how I would really valuably spend my time moving closer to that. So if I wasn't a Buddhist before that day, I definitely became one. And questions I had just vanished. Bante became my teacher. And this community was a sangha I was going to practice in. And I think these early experiences really sort of laid the foundations for my involvement, really. Really, I think my path since then has been allowing those seeds that were sown on those early events to unfold. I remember leaving the event, and it was dark, and it was raining slightly, and I was blissfully happy. I felt a real gratitude to Bante and to the people I've seen. And I kind of felt like, well, this path is just going to be a one long adventure that would enable me to grow as an individual and benefit others. And I think it was really important that I actually met people, because I think, you know, well, I'd read this book and I felt like, well, there is a path, but actually, is it real? Can you really practice it? You know, does it work? And I think actually meeting people and hearing the stories, I just knew. I thought, well, yes. I felt that just by following the path, I would get closer to those answers to the questions I'd ask myself that beset me on the plane and lying in bed that night. And I knew that this path was one of love and generosity, clarity, fearlessness, and would address the fundamental problems of life. So, yeah, I was very deeply happy. The search, although I'd been searching consciously for a couple of years, it felt like I'd been on this long, long search. I felt like I'd been on this search forever, and finally I found it. So I was like, yes. So yeah, I kind of then thought, well, okay, I'm going to do this now. And what's going to actually happen to me? How am I going to change? What does it involve, really? I was kind of excited, but I also knew I was going to change. And how? How would that happen? So I did look to Bante again, and his close disciples were really an example of what happens and what keeps happening when you keep committing yourself. And I think there's a three or four, there's lots of things that inspire me about Bante, but when I was thinking about talking about him today, it was a few aspects came to mind, so I'm going to just talk about these particular aspects. And it might just be things I'm thinking about at the moment. So the first thing, I think this is central for me, is I was inspired and reassured by Bante's devotion to the Buddha. So it was a historical figure who lived 2,500 years ago, who taught for many years and then died, and whose example keeps inspiring and has inspired, you know, humanity as a whole and the whole of the Buddhist tradition. So I think I was reassured by this because I wanted the spiritual life that I was, you know, about to embark on to be rooted in history somehow. I wanted it to be connected to more than just an individual's experience or a few individuals' experience. So the fact that the Buddha shares his enlightenment experience and then other people have the same experience and, you know, many, many thousands of people, you know, and crossing cultures and times, and it's still alive, I felt very assured that I was engaging in something that was very, very deep and profound. And the fact that Bante places the Buddha centrally means that, you know, I've got a connection, direct connection to the source, if you like, sort of fountain of this whole, you know, ocean of wisdom, let's say. So Bante loves the Buddha, and he's uncompromising in his devotion to the Buddha. And I think that expresses itself in many ways. Obviously, there's loads of lectures and books and where the Buddha features, but I think you get a real sense of his devotion to the Buddha through his poetry. So I know his poetry is not to everybody's taste. It's quite formal, the style. But I think if you look beyond that to his actual words and meaning, his love for the Buddha and his reverence for the Buddha is really very sort of apparent, very strong. And I remember being struck by this at an event when somebody read his poem Taking Refuge in the Buddha. So I was on the path. I'd been following, I think I was a mitra at this point, and I'd been following the path. But I sort of listened to this poem and I thought, oh, it was a challenging poem for me to hear, because he talks in this poem about really dismissing the things that normally give us security and identity and a sense of meaning, the normal things that do that. So one of the verses are, not where the gaunt cross rises, not where the crescent shines like a drawn blade in the heavens, not where the gopi pines, not where the organ thunders, not where the tom-toms beat, not where the conch is wailing, my place is at thy feet. And he goes through, you know, talking about commerce and nature and music and other religions, you know, sort of negating them each time. Even a literal interpretation of the Dharma. And I remember listening to it and thinking, God, that clarity there, that sort of commitment to the Buddha, wow, yes. And at the same time, I thought, no. Because I thought, well, I like my music. And I like all these, you know, things. They don't just give me pleasure. You know, I actually get a sense of who I am from those things. So I wasn't ready to let go. Very uncompromising his dedication to the Buddha. And the recognition that the Buddha is the only place of true refuge. So you've got this commitment, and you've also got this passion. It's like, when I was reading his poem, I thought it's like a simmering fervour, really, that, you know, which for the truth, you know, desire for the truth, which occasionally sort of bursts into ecstasy. And it's quite interesting because Bante is he comes across as a very reserved figure, really, man. Not particularly charismatic. I certainly didn't think so when I first met him. But his passion is really clear there. So in another poem called To the Recumbent Buddha, he speaks about visiting a temple in Kusinara. And he says, couched on my knees before thy figure vast, soothed by the stillness of this silent place, after much striving I behold at last the lamp illumined beauty of thy face, and trembling, feel around, below, above, the pulsing of thy vibrant peace and love. And he has another poem, Longing, in which he says, for the boundless, the unlimited, the infinite I long, unfold the wings of my heart like the wings of a bird in song, at the midmost arch of the sky, in the full blaze of the sun, I think that says, when the ear can hear its note, though the eye tracks not its way. So actually, I wanted to find this poem, and I put in longing. And then, you know, Neil, if you've got Evernote, I don't know if you've got Evernote, the kind of app, you put in, you can search, you know, so I put in longing, and it was just loads and loads of references, you know, and I thought, wow, it's all through his poem, it's real longing. So, yeah, devotion is the word, reverence is the word, love is the word, gratitude is the word, I think, to describe Bhante's connection to the Buddha, and unswerving love. I think the Buddha's a real presence for Bhante. And a real sense of gratitude, as I said. And I think Bhante said that if he hadn't discovered the Dharma, something that he could revere and look up to, he would have gone mad. And I think he means that quite literally. Because the forces in him, the drives in him, the strength of his intellect, his passion, needed something vast to contain it, to channel. And so the Buddha represents that figure for him. So yes, I think as he's connected to the Buddha that way, he's opened the gateway for us to do that. And I've loved hearing Bhante's stories of the Buddha. And, you know, he really sees what's relevant for us today in the Buddha's life. So Bhante's both a storyteller and a great translator, as well as a scholar. He says of translation, translation is making known something that was unknown, bringing something up from the depths, from, if you like, the unconscious, bring it into the light of consciousness, and in this way making it generally available. So that's what he does. Hidden meanings of the Buddha have been revealed for us. So I read, my connection with the Buddha started with on that first retreat, but I think it really grew when I read my next book, was The Guide to the Buddhist Path. I don't know if it's still in print, but it's such a fantastic book, partly because there's loads of illustrations in it. I feel the Buddha is a real presence for me. I know Bhante has opened the doorway for that. So another aspect that inspires me about Bhante is about really what does a full Dharma life look like, at least for me. And it's him as a mystic and an artist. So I thought about the word mystic and mysticism, and I looked some definitions of it. So one is extraordinary experiences and states of mind. Another one is mysticism, then, is a perception of the universe and all of its seemingly disparate entities existing in a unified whole, bound together by love. Another one is a mystical experience is an intuitive understanding and realization of the meaning of existence. An intuitive understanding and realization which is intense, integrating, self-authenticating, liberating, i.e. providing a sense of release from ordinary awareness. I thought a great quote, actually. So before coming into contact with the Dharma, I read Carl Jung, later Joseph Campbell, who introduced me to myth, and I found that all really fascinating. Although I didn't know from reading those books how it would change my life. But, you know, I found them interesting and I wanted to know more, but I didn't know how I could apply it, I guess. So Bhante, basically really shows us how the world of myths and dreams and higher states of consciousness in meditation and experiences you might have in nature, you know, how engaging in the imagination, all of that, actually how it helps us overcome our suffering. And so for me that was really crucial, because I sort of took to meditation after my first initial experiences. I took to meditation, and I have a dreaming sort of tendency. I have lots of dreams and they're quite vivid. But that's me personally, but it's also in my family and in the culture I'm from. So in the culture I'm from, my dad would ring and say, I dreamt of you last night, what's going on, you know. It's kind of very common, and people would speak about ghosts, and we call them jumbies. And so the kind of material world was not the be-all and end-all, you know, in the kind of family I grew up in. So I'm kind of was familiar with that, I guess. But it was kind of like, how to use those experiences, if you have experiences, how to then actually help them transform oneself. That was a question I had. So Abante says in his book, The Realm of the Lotus, I've often thought that we have two parallel lives, a waking life and a dream life. We sleep for so many hours a night, and our sleep is always full of dreams, whether we remember them or not. But when we do remember, it is as if the dream world interpenetrates to some extent with the world of our waking experience to produce another different and enriching level of experience. And then he goes on to say, I've sometimes thought that we can reach higher states of consciousness, not just from the waking state, but also from the dream state. Only note that I say from the dream state. It's not that we have the experiences in the dream state, but we attain them from the dream state. So that's Bante being really clear that we understand what that means. He then talks about visions he's had and the many visionary experiences his teachers have had as well. And it really helped me that, you know, I thought, well, that's great, because I have a teacher who sort of is comfortable with that whole realm, who speaks confidently about dreams and, you know, that imaginal realm. But really, importantly, shows us how it makes a difference to life and our questions and problems in life. So the world of myth is really woven into Bante's teachings in a way that's, you know, is focused on resolving life's problems and helping us grow as people. And so these experiences can be useful in helping us to develop higher states of consciousness and positive emotion, which in turn can purify our minds, our intentions, bring our energies together, bring more of our energies into being firstly, and then bring them together so we're integrating them. So that we can then more easily absorb wisdom. That's the point of them, really. So we're back to vision and transformation, that original book, really. Having a vision and then transforming yourself in accordance with that. So as a result of that, I've been able to sort of integrate some of the experiences I've had, dreams and other experiences along the way. But there was one experience that I really struggled with, and I spoke to lots of people and no one sort of could really help me. And I actually felt I was going a bit mad at one point. And it was to do with a past life experience that was kind of affecting me now, you know. So that was the confusion. I thought, well, this isn't me. It wasn't my life, and yet it felt like it was impacting on me, and I couldn't understand it, and it was affecting my day to day life and in my meditations. So I wrote to Bante and I went to see him, and he was brilliant because he just helped me normalize it, really. And what I got from the talking with him about it was, well, there is continuum from, you know, one life to another, and you don't know how it's going to play out. But an example, really, of how complex life is, and how little we know of how the universe works. And he was also very practical, and suggested I do another meditation practice, which I did, and I still do to this day. And it completely helped. You know, my sort of feeling like things were really strange completely changed after that. Started doing the practice and I felt normal again, and I was phew. And then I asked him, I said, well, what do you do then if there has been this unskillful act in a previous life, if you like, which I wish it would be, I guess. What do I do now about it? What can I do? So I guess I was asking for a teaching from him. And he said, he just looked at me and said, always do what you say you're going to do. So I thought, okay. I didn't really see how that related to what we were talking about. It wasn't a kind of direct connection at all. I kind of thought, okay, I can do that. I thought, I'll just add that to my practices that I'm doing. Tick it off, so a bit later on I can say, yes, I always do what I say I'm going to do. But I had no idea what a practice that would be for me. Years later, I'm still trying to do what I say I'm going to do. It just felt a really simple thing, but for me, it's been really, it's like a hidden teaching that I just bring to mind. And no one before that had ever said anything to me about, Surigupta, you don't do what you say you're going to do. No one had ever said that to me, and it's never been said to me, actually. So I feel like I'm a very responsible person, and so I kind of couldn't understand it, and yet, I, having tried to practice it, it's such a hard practice. So another time I went to see him, it was my first meeting with him, actually. I'd been exploring my ancestors and my cultural identity. And it was very important sort of just exploration I was had. But I came up against the fact that at that time we were called the Western Buddhist Order. And I thought, I know why we're called the Western Buddhist Order, but it doesn't quite resonate with me because my roots are not in the West. You know, and lots of people's roots are not in the West. So I sort of wrote to him and, you know, he invited me to go and see him. And I basically told him, I had a whole view about this, so I sort of shared my view about, you know, why we shouldn't be called the Western Buddhist Order and all the rest of it. And, you know, he really listened, and he seemed really interested. And then at a certain point we sort of got into a kind of exchange, because I don't know if I was interrupting him. I might have been interrupting a bit. So he was saying something, and I was kind of coming back with my view. And then suddenly it stopped, and he just looked at me. And so I just stopped. So I better stop talking right now. And I just looked at him, and he said, "Your roots are in the sky." And I stared at him. You know, my mouth was open, and I had this image, really strong graphic image, straight away of a tree, you know, upside down, you know, in the sky. And it was so I was in that kind of state of shock, and I was also at the same time really exhilarated by this experience. And I remember going back to the community where I was living at the time, and people said, "Well, how'd it go?" You know, and I couldn't talk, you know, I just couldn't say anything. I was just completely shaken up by the whole experience. And I looked up the reference. It's from the Bhagavad Gita, which is an old Hindu text. And it's interesting that the sort of image of trees and roots and skies is still very strong for me now, even years later after that. So, Bhante the mystic, sometimes Bhante the artist who can really, you know, skillfully use the language of images and metaphors. It was exactly the right thing to do for me because I was quite in my, you know, I had this whole intellectual argument going, and it just completely took the rug from under that and opened up a whole other world and another way of seeing myself. So, how are we doing for time?
1:45.
Okay, so the other thing I want to talk about, so that's Bhante the artist. I'll read this quote because I think it's from the Guide to the Buddhist Path, and he says, he talks about the role of imagination, and he basically says, we may say there are two kinds of truth. There's first of all what we call scientific truth, the truth of concept, the truth of reasoning. But in addition to this, and some would say even above this, there is what we may call poetic truth, or truth of the imagination. And this is a truth of images, truth of intuition, and both are at least equally important. And the second, the latter kind of truth, the truth of images, the truth of poetry, truth of the imagination, the intuition, this is manifested or revealed in what we call myths and legends, as well as in art, symbolic ritual, and dreams. So Bhante is going to, on the August weekend, I don't know if any of you are going to that, there's a celebration. It's going to be a whole focus on his appreciation of the arts and culture. So I think just for me, all I want to say around that is that it had a very direct influence on me, the way he spoke about arts and culture, not just in my practice, but in my life as a whole. So I've always loved the world of stories and myths, leaving university, I thought I needed to go and help people. You know, the world was suffering and I needed to help people. So I became a social worker. But I was at the same time, I was living and practicing in community. So I had two very different realities. I would go to work and it was very real harsh realities, real sort of grim things. And then I'd been in this, you know, living around the London Buddhist Centre and you know, meditating a lot, and the whole world of beauty and going on retreats. It was a very different world, and that world really supported the work I was doing. But a certain point came where I just thought I wanted to bring the mythic world, my imaginal world, out more, I guess. And I was inspired by Dada Rinpoche in the school that he had as well, and Bhante's real importance that he places on the arts. So when my son was a toddler, I went to see Bhante, and I said to him, I want to work with children as a Buddhist. And he was just very sort of encouraging, and you know, he was smiling. And I didn't know how I was going to do that. I was already working with children as a social worker, but I knew that wasn't. I wanted to somehow bring the mythic dimension into the work I was doing with children. And I didn't know how, but not long after that, I was on the order convention, and I was sitting opposite another order member, and I said to him, "What do you do for a living?" And he said, "Oh, I'm a storyteller." I said, "You're what?" He said, "I'm a storyteller." I was like, "That's what I'm going to do." And he kind of looked a bit, and I don't know if I've got this memory of like getting up and walking out. I'm sure I didn't do that, but it was like suddenly, you know, a whole, I just thought, that is it, that's what I've been looking for. And within a month after that, I became a professional storyteller. And I don't actually think I would have done that if I hadn't had had Bhante's understanding of the significance of the arts. I think I would have felt I was slightly indulging, really. You know, to leave social work to be a storyteller, it just, you know, in my old way of thinking, it would have been, you know, not right. As well as the fact that I was a mum and I was a sole provider for my son, so to leave a stable career into the exploring this other world, I definitely don't think I would have done it without that whole understanding that I had from Bhante. So I had a lovely time as a storyteller. I did it for 8 to 10 years, pretty much full time. Earned more than I did when I was being a social worker. So I was like, that was good as well. And I saw firsthand the transformative power of myths and, you know, stories and beauty. You know, so I'd go into prisons and hospitals and schools and all kinds of psychiatric wards, and it was just very, it was always amazed me what impact, you know, just telling stories could have and introducing people to the world of myth. And it changed me too. It was transformative both ways. So the last thing, so yes, that's Bhante as the artist, somebody who really understands and appreciates the arts. He's obviously writes his poetry, but I think his artistic temperament also comes out in the way he teaches the dance. So, lastly, I just want to talk about Bhante as a social radical. I was a social worker, and I was very interested into social justice and equality, and that sort of drove me, really. And so I didn't want my practice to just be about me, somehow. So the fact that Bhante, you know, sort of was worked and instigated the whole movement in India, working with the scheduled castes and the Dalits, there really inspired me. You know, he's really supported the work of Ambedkar. You know, the fear I had early on that I'd be on this lovely, you know, environment and I'd be floating off on meditation and really disconnect to others, totally, you know, is not how it is. So I'm very grateful for Bhante for keeping that alive, particularly for us in the West, because I think we're quite comfortable, you know, comparatively. So really keeping alive the fact that actually the Dharma is a tool for social change. And I've gotten more and more faith in that as I've practiced, you know, how the Dharma, you know, can be used as the best, actually, way to transform society, because we're creating a situation where people have a real sense of solidarity with another person, and a real sense of mutual respect. Actually, I said lastly, the only other thing I want to say about Bhante's qualities that have inspired me and made me think about what's it like to live a full dharmic life is around his emphasis on clear communication and thinking. And that's something I really aspire to do, to communicate clearly, to think clearly. And Bhante says, it's a lovely little book actually, The Realm of the Lotus, which is an interview with him and an artist. But he says there, I think the important thing for me is clarity. I want to make things clear, either to myself or others. And then the interviewer, Elaine Melander, says, clarity is very rare nowadays. And then Bante replies with, yes, I get a little annoyed when people are confused in their thinking and use words clumsily. I consider this a sort of intellectual laziness and perhaps spiritual laziness as well. So there we go. So it is a practice. It is a practice to learn to speak clearly, or just even to recognise when our thinking is confused. And it's a really good practice, because I think, you know, from recognising that, we can then, you know, sort of get clearer. So that's Bante, the artist, the mystic, the social radical, the clear thinker, and the lover of the Buddha. And I think when you're inspired by something, it's often a reflection of oneself or what one aspires to be or do. And I'm aspiring to be some of those things, I guess. But how to bring them together? You know, they're actually, in some ways, they're quite opposite qualities, aspects. And Bante talks about, you know, Sangharakshita 1 and Sangharakshita 2. So Sangharakshita 1 was the kind of monk who was, you know, living a very traditional Buddhist life, was ascetic, and was very disciplined. And Sangharakshita 2 was the artist, the lover of poetry and, you know, just the culture. And he couldn't connect the two things. In fact, the tension became quite strong, and Sangharakshita 1, one day, burns Sangharakshita 2's, all his books, notebooks, and his writings. So that's pretty intense, isn't it? Really quite violent. I remember reading this and thinking, I'm so relieved, actually. It's horrible for Bante, but I remember thinking, oh, it's not just me that has all these things pulling in different directions. Bante, you know, has had that problem. For me, I had Suryagupta 1 to 4, Suryagupta 1 to 5. I had so many different things competing, really. But I sort of felt that, he says it is possible to integrate them. But it doesn't come from suppressing one over the other. It does take time. And sometimes they have to coexist. In fact, he says there has to be, it seems, a sort of fruitful tension or even a fruitful conflict between the two as they interact with each other. So I feel like my journey in life, my way that my spiritual life has unfolded thus far, has been, you know, these different sort of aspects emerging, at different phases, basically. One day they may all come together. So only I'm not as impacted by the conflicts, the tensions, as I once were, so that's great. And I think that also shows that the spiritual life, a life fully lived, is not always neat, is not neat and tidy. I remember going for phrases, I just want to be normal, I just want to be ordinary, I just want to, you know, but, you know, it's actually not like that. I think the more one uncovers about oneself, the more fascinating it is, but actually the more there is to integrate as well. But I think, so we've got a choice, I think. We've got a choice to kind of live a safe life, a contained life, a life that's kind of narrow, but actually it feels safe on one level, or a life that actually keeps opening up and presenting us with different ways of seeing the world and different ways of seeing ourselves. And it can feel a bit... perilous or a bit sort of, well, it's just the unknown, isn't it? We don't know what we're going to find. But we have a choice, and certainly I've made that choice that I much prefer the path of ongoing unfoldment. So in Bante, because he's doing that and he's done that for many, many years, and his disciples have been doing that and, you know, have done that, it gives me confidence that, you know, actually what results is love. Connection, generosity, that is the fruits of this path. And I think, yeah, I just want to end with, I think one of the fruits actually, and you know, there's lots of treasures along the way that one sees and uncovers and fruits, and I think one of them is a quality that comes out more and more is kindness. And I've personally benefited from Bante's kindness, particularly when I was pregnant with my son. It was I was newly ordained, and it was a days where, well, the order member to get pregnant was still quite controversial, and so people responded in many different ways to me, and not always very positively. I think Pope didn't know how to respond. That was partly it as well. And Bante at that time really extended the hands of friendship to me, and he had faith in my going for refuge. I sort of just knew he had faith in my practice. So I took my son to see him when he was born, and it was great because he sat him on his knee and we kind of looked at each other. And again later on I took him to see him, and when he was a toddler, it was so funny because Bante was sitting in the chair and he had a smile on his face. And then he just took out from nowhere one of those wooden snakes. My son came towards him and then this snake, It was just really great. He just was very kind and very sort of supportive. And it gave me, I didn't question my going for refuge, but I think being in that situation, that challenging situation, I felt, but having Bante's, sort of affirmation, I guess, I just felt that it deepened my faith. The whole experience deepened my faith in the three jewels. The Buddha and Dharma, yes, definitely. The Sangha was a challenging experience for me at that time, but the fact that Bante, being the founder of the movement, and my preceptor, and some close friends, the fact that they were so supportive just meant that I thought, well, as long as I've got that, I'll just keep practicing in this context. So I'm very, very grateful for him. And I'm grateful to his capacity for friendship generally and his love for people. Bante talks about sort of ordaining people, the first people he ordained, as lighting lamps, and how his own going for refuge was now bound up with the going for refuge of others. So I think that's an important aspect of Bante, is his capacity for friendship. You can see that through the sort of personal connections he's got with his very close disciples. They're just devoted to him, and they've given their lives actually to helping him, establish this movement. But his love also shows, I think, in the way he teaches, the way he shares the Dharma. He's completely open and generous in the way he does that. And I think I probably saw something of the love that Bante has for people, and the influence of that at that very first event, the Dada Rinpoche death anniversary festival. Bante spoke about his friendship then with Dado, and talked about looking up to him and revering him. And later, I don't know if he said it then, but certainly I understood later that Bante said that Dada Rinpoche said that Bante's disciples were like his own disciples. And I found that interesting at the time. I remember hearing that, thinking, that's really interesting. But that's become true for me. Dado Rinpoche, who's somebody I've never met, never read any of his teachings, has been very present in my life as well, which is one of those fascinating things. And in particularly some of my challenging times as well as inspiring me to do some of the works I've done. What do I want to end with? I think just seeing his disciples, that woman on the stage that day who I was very impressed with for ethics, she became later became my preceptor, Sangha Devi, and she's played a very important role in my life. And I know I wouldn't have come across any of those people, any of you, today, if, Bante hadn't done what he's done. I didn't keep up writing to Bante, but I do think of him often, like the Buddha. I think of the Buddha often, I think of Bante often, I think of Dada Rinpoche often, and my preceptor. I know that my life would not have any degree of meaning and fulfilment that it's had, if it wasn't for them. I wouldn't have grown from the challenges I've had if it wasn't for the fact that Bante has kept lighting, these lamps, and in turn inspired other people to do so. I dreamt of him actually in January. He was in my dream, and he was exhorting me and others to keep his teachings alive. So I feel that the main way I can repay the debt of gratitude I feel is to live my Dharma life fully, and to keep Bhante's unique contribution to the Dharma, to the Buddha Dharma, alive.
Thank you. Thank you.
Beautiful talk, Sariputta. Thank you so much for that. And it just resonated with people who were here last week. It resonated quite a bit, you know, the Noble Eightfold Path paper. Mm-hmm. But yeah. it was for me as well. It's my first book. Mm. Yeah, it came out about the time when I was thinking of becoming a Mitra, about 1990 or
right,
something.
Yeah.
It came out, didn't it? And it was one of his first books of that sort of book, you know, right. The edited transcript. And Manju Bajra last week was talking about hearing the talks of the Noble Eightfold Path series.
Yes.
Yeah, so.
And we're studying it this afternoon.
Are you?
Right by then this afternoon.
And in those days, there weren't that many books about,
no,
so it was a real thing. This book came out. Oh, we must all have it. You know, we all read it. And
oh, I had no idea of that.
That's
interesting. Yeah,
yeah.
Just my first book I picked up. Okay.
Just so, thank you. I mean, when I asked you to come, I knew it'd be good, but it was brilliant. Thank you so much. Sorry,
thank you very much.
Thank you. Everyone that comes, we say that we like. We always like. Come again.
Come again.
Come and tell us some stories.
Oh, yes.
Love stories. And I think you would be a fairly good
storyteller.
Good
story. Yeah. Yeah. Now I'm not doing it professionally anymore, so I feel like, because before I would ask me to tell stories, but because I was doing it like every day, you know, I didn't do it very often at centres actually, so now I'm no longer.
Do you tell stories about the Buddha?
I have done, but not as a performance.
No.
So that would be quite interesting to do that actually.
Yeah.
So yeah. And I've got people telling, you know, like we used to do a lot of parents and children's retreats, and they were great fun because we would enact these great stories and things like that. We've done.
It's been on that one.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, we must stop.
Yes,
thank you. Jane is making all these talks possible.